power workshop. I am connected to Lisbon from very first days of my life because of St. Anthony Church in Prague and my baptism. But another important connection of the Czech Republic and Portugal after election of Václav Havel in December 89 as president of Czechoslovakia, he had no Czech-made limousine, only horrible big and ugly Soviet one. So former Portuguese President Soares sent a special gift from Portugal to Prague. So our president used first 6 months of his presidential period Portuguese limousine. So it's another important connection between our countries. We are here in a constellation of representatives of two parallel workshops, D and E. It's my pleasure to introduce you to Katerina Levchenko from Ukraine. She is reporter of workshop D, Xenophobia and Racism. We had two panelists during this workshop, Nurse Muzneks from ECRI and Gitu Mulgari, United Nations Special Rapporteur on Racism, Xenophobia and Related Intolerance. And the main aim of our workshop was to formulate a set of recommendations for governments, for international organizations and NGOs, and to identify policy solutions for our states. So let me ask Katerina to make summary of our workshop D on xenophobia and racism towards immigrants, and the same procedure will be later in case of workshop E. Katerina.
Thank you very much, Peter. And I'm a reporter from workshop on racism, combating racism and xenophobia. And first of all, I'd like to thank panelists and all participants of the workshop for the full of ideas, information and recommendations, speeches and interventions. Any doubt that tolerance and pluralism are basic principles of democratic society? At the same time, xenophobia and racism, as well as migration, do not know and do not admit the borders. Nevertheless, the states have an important role to play in ensuring that people are able to live without fear of racism and xenophobia. But as Mr. Gisu Mugari, UN Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Form of Racism, mentioned during the workshop, governments alone never solve the problems of racism and xenophobia. Important task to encourage and energize the civil society, grassroots organization to be involved in this activity. And as Mr. Muzhnik, Chair of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, stressed, civil society is an important partner for ECRI, both in the process of gathering information and promotion the ideas of tolerance and non-discrimination. One more important player in the combating racism and xenophobia is an international community. European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, with its very important monitoring function and active role in developing the model legislation in this area. Commission on Human Rights of the Council of Europe, United Nations Human Rights Treaties Bodies and Special Procedures. First of all, UN Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia and Related Intolerance. Committee on Migrant Workers, European Committee on Migrations and others. Speaking about racism during the workshop, we follow the broad definition which was presented by Mr. Muzhnik. According to this definition, racism is belief that race, color, language, religious, nationality, or national, ethnic origin justify contempt for a person or the notion of a superiority of a group of persons. Racism and xenophobia are the challenges of the 21st century. The next modern trends directly or indirectly affects migrants, asylum seekers and refugees. The first post so-called 9/11 discourse linking immigrations with crime and terrorism. Linkage of asylum to abuse and public debate. Migration debates is being connected with economical crisis. Using of anti-migrant racist elements in mainstream political discourse. Increasing amount of racist attacks. Ethnic profiling as a part of policy. Many Eastern European countries only now are becoming the countries of destination for migrants and asylum seekers, playing the new role in the global migration process. Negative climate of public opinion about migration. Important questions, of course, are about the solution, possible ways of solution the existing problems. All suggestions of the panelists and participants can be grouped around the next main points. The first. First of all, using international legal instruments. International UN Convention on Elimination of Racial Discrimination. A Convention on Participation of Foreigners in the Public Life. Protocol number 12 to European Convention on Human Rights and Freedom. The second, developing and improving of the national legislation. National legislation plays an important role in combating racism and xenophobia. As it was mentioned above, European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance has developed the recommendation on the model law which are available for participants. The third level, the level of implementation of legal provisions. Effective and full implementations play a crucial role. As recommendation for the final conference document come down from the speeches and intervention, I would now mention the next. Trainings for specialists and professionals, especially law enforcement bodies, border police and migration services. Developing the educational programs with a special accent on their content for children, for young people. Implementing multicultural lessons for children. Active mass media involving in promotion ideas of tolerance and non-discrimination. Data collection improving. Policy audit to address racial ethnic profile. Wrapping up, I'd like to repeat the very important thesis for final recommendations from speeches. Need for human rights-based debates. Need to involve migrants, asylum seekers and refugees and listen to them. Need to include anti-racism and non-discrimination in integration policy. Need to learn best practices from others, including Portuguese one, which was presented during workshop. And the last one, to continue activity of Council of Europe in area of migration issues, combating racism, xenophobia, intolerance, and all forms of discrimination. Thank you.
Thank you, Katerina. Our proposal is to listen to summary of workshop E, and after that to open final discussion together. Thank you.
So now we have Thomas Mana. He's a lawyer and working for the Ministry of Interior in Hungary, and also professor or lecturer in public international law at the University in Budapest. So he's going to report on workshop E. We've been speaking and then discussing on expulsion and false return. So, Thomas, the floor is for you.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Chair. Dear participants, ladies and gentlemen, now I have the honor to present you the very last report of the last workshop, which was entitled Expansion and Forced Return. If you take the title of the workshop, this is clear that it's a real multifaceted issue. The return, forced return expansion, can be conceived as an umbrella covering a lot of topics. For me, to my understanding, forced return and expansion in human rights perspective mean two things. First, what are the obstacles, what are the human rights obstacles and concerns preventing return? Second, if returns are carried out, what are the safeguards, the guarantees, and human rights standards to meet and to be respected during the return process? So we can conceive it as before return there are some obstacles, and if return takes place, what are the human rights safeguards? As for the composition of the workshop, we had two speakers. They both gave really excellent presentations, giving in the meantime an overview of the relevant topics and an in-depth analysis of issues of high concern. Moreover, our moderator, Christina, on my left side, gave a pretty good introduction, and all the interventions were really useful. Besides the official speakers, we had six questions at the end. I think there could have been even more, but because of lack of time, we had to finish collecting questions. So all in all, it showed a lot of interest, and there were vivid discussions. What is the starting point? The starting point is, once again, a dilemma between state sovereignty and human rights protection. Another point of departure is the fact to be highlighted that forced return as such is applicable to all individual illegally staying, irrespective why they are illegally present on the territory of the country. So they can be rejected asylum seekers, irregular migrants, overstayers, or regular migrants committing crimes, or stateless persons. So the persons to be covered, or the persons touched by forced return, is a really huge pool. Another, let's say, general consideration is that expansion as such is not completely illegal. It's allowed. It derives from state sovereignty. Of course, there are limits, and expansion can be exercised within limits, and these human rights-related limits are important and very important for us during the workshop. The very first thing to consider is the well-known and famous principle of non-refoulement. Non-refoulement is not only a refugee law principle, as was stated by the orateur, but still, it's a general, or more general, human rights law principle as well, which can be considered as a direct and indirect obligation for states. Non-refoulement is enshrined in a lot of international instruments, in universal ones, for example, the Geneva Convention on the Status of Refugees, the most important, plus we have the UN Convention Against Torture, as well as there are regional instruments, the most famous is the European Convention on Human Rights. Moreover, there's a massive jurisprudence on non-refoulement of the European Court of Human Rights, plus you can find international bodies, quasi-judicial, such as the Human Rights Committee, or technical bodies, such as the Executive Committee of the UNHCR, dealing and elaborating more on this principle. All in all, we can state that Non-refoulement is a jus cogens norm in international law. That means it's a peremptory norm under which no derogation is permissible. And what are the challenges in practice concerning the principle of non-refoulement? It was the very topic of Mr. Olivier Bia, who gave a really profound analysis of the issues of concern. First challenge is the mixed flows, when not only asylum seekers try to cross borders, but with other migrants. And for asylum seekers, their goal is not a migratory one. They seek protection, since the country of origin cannot give it to them. Another issue is the migrants using abusively the asylum systems, and I'm once again speaking about mixed flows. And another one, the third one, when state authorities return asylum seekers or return persons before allowing them to apply for asylum. So in this case, there's no opportunity to lodge a claim. And if such a return takes place, in many cases, they are returned to unsafe third countries, which is unacceptable as well. Leaving now non-refoulement, which is the real cornerstone of the human rights implications of a forced return, there are other limitations to the state's authority. For example, no collection expulsion is permitted, which is enshrined in the international covenants on political and civil rights or on the regional level in the European Convention on Human Rights. Moreover, there are other limits of human rights law, especially we can find them in the European Convention on Human Rights. Just some examples. Article 2 on right to life. Article 8 on right to family life or right to private life. And it is applicable when non-refoulement cannot or doesn't come into play, but according to the court, the moral and physical integrity of the person concerned would be damaged because of return. Invocation or reference to Article 8 can prevent return. And there are other articles as well, such as Article 10 or Article 12 in the European Convention. So all in all, there's a quite massive net of protection. However, in practice, states do not always respect these obligations, which is shown by the high number of applications to the European Court of Human Rights because of such violations. To sum up to this point, we can identify four regimes applicable. We have the Geneva Convention, we have the International Covenant on Civil Political Rights, we have the Convention Against Torture, and we have the European Convention on Human Rights. And these four treaty regimes are applicable to all 47 Council of Europe member states. Besides the Council of Europe level, we have touched upon briefly the EU regime as well, referring to the Asylum Acquis with Dublin II regulations and the Return Directive. So these are the relevant sources of law with géométrie variable. Plus, as a general policy context, we have to highlight the Stockholm Programme, adopted at the end of last year, as well as the European Pact on Immigration and Asylum, adopted in October 2008 under the French presidency. And these two policy documents are envisaging the evaluation of the readmission agreements, for example, concluded on the EU level, and they require sustainable return from the EU member states. Moving forward, the second part of my presentation, I would like to red flag some specific issues which were mentioned. First, is the case of regular migrants committing crimes. It's a quite interesting case or These are quite interesting cases. And within this context, the proportionality principle is essential to be applied. Our speaker, Nula Mola, mentioned that there were some ridiculous cases in this regard in the UK. Another specific issue is that of the safe third countries. And even we have at least one EU member state with not a really effective asylum determination procedure, and these countries can raise problems as well. A third specific issue is voluntary return. It was briefly touched upon concerning the issue that in some cases voluntary return is not really voluntary, but there are some pressure hidden. Forced return is the next one, and the related problems. In some cases, returnees committed suicide after returning home. It's just a specific example, but staying on the more general level, this is the place to talk a bit about the readmission agreements, since these are the means of implementing and carrying out forced returns. As for the readmission agreements, under international law, there's a general obligation of all states to readmit their own nationals. It's a rule of customary nature, full stop. Why do we need readmission agreements if there's such an obligation? The reason is, this is quite a vague obligation, and in practice, without any further clarification, it cannot be really applied. That's why states conclude readmission agreements to reaffirm this obligation, plus precise this obligation with deadlines, with procedural rules, etc., etc. Moreover, these agreements deal with the readmission of third country nationals and stateless persons as well, which is not a general international law obligation. So this can be conceived as the added value or an added value of the readmission agreements. And if readmission agreements are touched upon, there are generally two main positions. The first says that they are neutral instruments. They have nothing to do with human rights. They are technical instruments, and that's it. The second position or point of view is more concerned about human rights violations because of the application of readmission agreements, especially when third country nationals or stateless persons are readmitted to countries from where they had transited before. Without deciding on which side is right, just some reflections on the latest developments in the field of readmission agreements. It is without any doubt that the EU is now concluding a lot of readmission agreements. It's a high policy goal for the time being. And these agreements contain clauses, the so-called non-affectation clauses, saying other human rights, refugee law obligations in course of readmission shall be respected. And these readmission agreements are not only technical instruments, but for the EU they serve as elements in carrying out the general external relations policy goals. In relation to these agreements, two things to mention. First, the question of monitoring systems. It's really important, since if we don't know anything about the person readmitted after the readmission, it's just half success. So monitoring and following what happened after readmission, it's really important. And the second thing, that even if we say as a point of departure that these agreements are neutral. In course of carrying out the readmission, there can be some human rights violations. For example, readmission taking place by plane, and on the plane there's no water, there's no food for the person concerned, or the escorts use force, unproportional manner, or without any reason. So these issues have to be addressed. And if I mention monitoring mechanisms, I'm recall it once again, since it's a really important issue. The Human Rights Committee requires from the states to monitor returns, as well as we have now in the EU the Return Directive setting such an obligation for the member states. And moving forward with the specific issues, I have only two left. The next one are the human rights concerns in case of using joint flights operations for returns. It was mentioned that, for example, there's one free seat in a plane, and in order to save money, without thorough examination of the case, the person is put on the plane to be returned, and it's a clear-cut violation. And lastly, specific attention is to be paid for vulnerable persons, if were raised by the speakers, for example, for minors, women, elderly people. So to sum up my a bit long resume, we've just witnessed another field where traditional state sovereignty is more and more challenged by the emerging corpus of human rights law and refugee law, and still it's quite difficult to find the equilibrium between the two. And another thing to highlight that in practice the instruments are often good, and there's nothing to criticize in them, and are in line with human rights obligation. But on the other hand, the implementation of these instruments is the weak point, and it is against international standards and violates human rights law. So, as a recommendation for the future, I think we have quite a thorough international and European legal framework for making human rights perspective and human rights to prevail. The challenge is to make and to ensure better implementation of these instruments and better implementation of return to be in line with human rights. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. And I think that we open the debate, do we?
Yes, if you have now urgent and substantial question, remarks, comments to our two rapporteurs, Katerina and Tamás, respectively to our panelists, it's now a good time for maybe 10-15 minutes. And then we will be ready for a concluding session. So, your questions. Buenos dias.
Buenas tardes. Gracias, presidente. Intervengo por dos motivos. Primero, para dar las gracias a los que han trabajado aquí, porque ahora Miguel Ángel y yo nos tenemos que ir. Me parecía una malcriadez irnos sin despedir. Primero, dar las gracias. Segundo, plantear que no hay lugar en el mundo donde más se protejan los derechos humanos que en Europa. Ningún lugar en el mundo. Seguramente porque en Europa se hacen estas cosas, que es que se reúnen juristas, se reúnen profesionales, se reúnen parlamentarios, se reúnen representantes de la sociedad civil, gobiernos, administraciones públicas, y permanentemente nos autoexigimos muchísimo. Nos autoexigimos muchísimo porque creemos mucho Europa y creemos mucho los derechos humanos. Dicho esto, hay que plantear que en el orden jurídico no hay ningún derecho internacional natural, son solo acuerdos entre Estados, acuerdos entre personas, no hay nada al margen de los acuerdos entre personas. Y segundo, plantear que lo fundamental no está en que se creen nuevas normas, sino en garantizar que se apliquen las que ya están. Si tan solo vigiláramos con detenimiento y con detalle que lo que ya está exista en la vida de la gente, sería una gran conquista. Porque no hay persona que cuando lea un texto internacional, un tratado de una ley, no afirme qué buena cosa. Pero luego en la vida cotidiana sabemos que hay muchos asuntos pendientes. Por eso acabo ya planteando que lo fundamental es que se hagan experiencias como esta, que se hagan debates como el que escuché en el taller este sobre expulsión, y plantearnos que la clave está en que cada vez más tengamos protocolos comunes, lenguajes comunes y formas de hacer en común, porque de esa manera podemos seguir avanzando en materia de derechos humanos y de protección de la gente que tiene derecho a la esperanza. Así que nada más, y muchas gracias, y amigas, y ya nos vamos, quedan liberados, porque ya no volverá a intervenir más. Eso es un gran éxito, por cierto.
Thank you. Another? Yes.
Muito obrigado. Relativamente às conclusões do workshop de hoje, queria só referir que pareceu-me a mim que havia uma separação artificial entre o exercício da soberania de um Estado e os direitos humanos. Queria só fazer uma precisão técnica, que é a seguinte. Num Estado de Direito, o exercício da soberania faz-se num quadro legal e constitucional definido, no qual, naturalmente, se inclui o cumprimento dos direitos humanos, plasmados num quadro legal que lhe é aplicável. Obrigado.
If our rapporteurs would like to react immediately, it's possible, of course.
May I say something? Yes, even my colleague is going, but I would like to point out that it is true, but not entirely true. Because sometimes, for example, in Spain, we have had the last immigration law has gone to the Constitutional Court, and the Court has decided that four articles were not constitutional regarding rights of migrants. So now we have reform, modify Spanish immigration law, with those changes regarding the rights of irregular migrants, you know. So, in general, it's true that probably, as my Spanish colleague said, it is normal that law, domestic law, European law, are more or less right. And then the very difficult issue is to reach practice and good practice in issues regarding human rights and migration. But sometimes even the laws, domestic law, European directives going to the Court of Justice, etc. So just to point it out.
Thank you. I would like to answer quickly in reverse order. As regards the second observation that it's an artificial separation between sovereignty and human rights, maybe I put it in a not the best way. When I told sovereignty, I wanted to refer to the state discretion to do things, the state authority to decide on who is staying on its territory, who is entering and who is leaving. So it's rather, of course, sovereignty is an overarching principle, is the basis of international law and our current international relations, etc., etc. So I try to do the comparison that we have human rights obligations, and on the other hand, there is, okay, let's put it in this way, state discretion, state power, state authority to regulate things according to its sake. Yeah, and the first observation, I fully agree with that. I think I try to push forward this kind of conclusion that, yeah, we have a thorough and quite comprehensive legal framework, universal, regional, European level, but what lacks is the effective implementation, and I think that was the point made. So I fully agree with him.
Thank you, Tomasz and Christina. And I was very surprised. I haven't seen hand from Malta in this discussion, and Kent is here. It's your floor.
I'm glad that I put an end to your surprise. No, I'd just like to join my... I do not intend to take the floor, but I think this is a very fundamental point. I'm coming from the background of the Council of Europe. And the Council of Europe rests on three pillars: democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. I think what my colleague was saying was not that state authorities are perfect. You mentioned, and rightly so, that states very often are in the wrong, and there is a constitutional framework, such as the courts, to redress it, but that is part of the state. I'm sorry to say. That is, the courts are part of the state. That is why sovereign states, it's very important in this discussion to underline that we need to bring states into the equation, because at the end of the day, it is states who are going to take the decision. And by states, I mean the whole framework. Government representatives, the courts, the whole gamut of what makes a state. Because at the end of the day, it was states who drew up the Convention of Human Rights. Nobody was putting a gun to member states' head when they signed the European Convention. They knew what they were doing. They wanted to... they were the ones who felt the need, following the tragedy of the Second World War, to put in place an effective monitoring mechanism to try to ensure that what happened 60 years ago does not happen again. So we need to underline this point that, yes, human rights can only function within the legitimacy of a state. And by state we mean even civil society. They are also part of the state. Thanks.
Thank you, and we have time for final two questions or reactions. Yes.
I'll just take the floor briefly. I hope to take the floor in the final session in terms of a general summing up. But I think that what our colleague from Malta says, in one sense, is right. It is for states to implement the legal frameworks. But I think what frustrates the members of the Council of Europe Assembly is that conventions are signed and ratified, but then they are not necessarily properly followed through. And in the field of migration, this, I think, the 2 days have shown the extent to which this is a problem, and especially in this area of forced returns and expulsions. And I think the second point about that is that I think we are frustrated that the legal instruments, the conventions, which many of which have flowed from recommendations from the three key pillars of the Council of Europe, the Committee of Ministers, the Assembly, and the Commissioner as well, in terms of the work that's done by all these different parts of the organisation, and the CDMG too, as part of this, is that the take-up of ratification of these conventions is slow, and in some areas just deliberately neglected. And I think that the conclusion I take from the 2 days is that this has been in some ways a vindication of the judgments that have been made by the Council of Europe, particularly from the point of view of the Assembly, and my colleague José Mendes Bota, I'm sure, agrees with this, that we've made recommendations to improve human rights in all of these areas, but they are just not adopted. That we don't necessarily need many more new ideas. We need the political world to adopt what is done. And I just want to react, now I've taken the floor, to something that Katerina said. I wasn't in your discussion, but you talked about migration in connection with the economic crisis. And the Assembly debated this whole subject for a whole afternoon, I think, in the April part session. And in the field of migration, we made some strong recommendations to the Committee of Ministers that they should not take the opportunity of people suddenly being out of work to throw them out of the country and to send them back to their country of origin. Because, and this is the point I made in my opening address yesterday morning, Europe needs migrants. And when the economic crisis is over and the upturn comes and construction starts all over again, even in places here like Lisbon where we see projects are having to be suspended for lack of resource, when this returns, we're going to need these people. And I think it's a very important message that we should all take back from these 2 days, that we need migrants, and we need to treat them fairly.
Thank you, John, for your comments and a very final intervention or question or comment. Yes, it's yours.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. J'ai parlé en français pour changer un peu. Pardonnez-moi les révérences. C'est parce qu'il m'est plus aisé de décrire une jurisprudence du Conseil de l'Europe que j'ai lue en français, bien qu'étant portugais. Je ne suis pas au Marais, j'appartiens à l'office du procureur général de la République, cabinet de médecin de la Trompala. Je voudrais dire qu'il y a un ton pessimiste qui flotte dans cette Assemblée, mais que le pessimisme pourrait peut-être être associé à la crise économique et financière à laquelle nous assistons, qui va peut-être conduire à des violences inénarrables et que nous devrions éviter, ou des accidents comme celui qui est arrivé hier matin en Méditerranée, mais que, en ce qui concerne l'asile, nous devrions être optimistes. Je me suis battu personnellement ici au Portugal pendant des années pour que le recours de la phase administrative à la phase judiciaire dans les lois d'asile devienne suspensif. Par miracle, il est devenu suspensif non seulement au Portugal, mais dans tous les pays d'Europe, pratiquement, entre 2005 et 2008. Ceci est extraordinaire. À quoi cela soit-il? Or, nous avons les directives de l'asile de 2005 de l'Union européenne, et nous avons des jurisprudences de la Cour de justice de la Communauté européenne, de la Communauté européenne qui, à des niveaux de protection subsidiaire, je ne parle pas de l'asile même, ici, je cite El Khafaji, nous avons des jurisprudences extraordinaires de la Cour européenne des droits de l'homme qui viennent déjà depuis très longtemps, non seulement depuis Kloosfalas contre Suède et Chaal, mais aussi dernièrement avec Gabrémédien contre la France ou Conca ou Savi, qui viennent nous articuler les articles 2, 3 et 13 de la Convention européenne des droits de l'homme pour nous dire qu'il faut un recours effectif pour que la personne puisse faire valoir son point de vue entre une phase administrative et une phase normalement judiciaire dans un recours d'asile. Ce recours effectif a été pris aussi dans les mots des directives de l'Union européenne qui parlent d'un recours effectif. La combinaison des deux a conduit à un changement généralisé des lois. C'est arrivé en France suite à Gabrémédien, c'est arrivé au Portugal, c'est arrivé dans notre pays. Je crois que si tout n'est pas un univers heureux dans le domaine de l'asile, et je ne me réfère qu'à ce paragraphe, ce moment de la suspensivité du recours, je me rapporte qu'à cette partie de la discussion, si tout n'est pas heureux en Europe, si tout n'est pas merveilleux, je pense que cependant nous avons une évolution qui n'était pas connue depuis de nombreuses années et que nous devons au contraire nous réjouir de l'état des choses. Je serai ici un peu optimiste comme l'était monsieur le professeur Nun Pissarre dans son intervention d'hier. Voilà ce que je voulais dire. Je vous remercie.
Okay, thank you. I have final two information for you. One is good, one is bad. Good is that I'll lose my microphone in 1 minute, and so it's a good time from my perspective to thank Council of Europe, especially Simon, and Portuguese authorities, especially Luisa, for all your hospitality and invitation and honor to chair this meeting. And bad news for you is there is no coffee break, and there will be only technological break for changing of representatives at this table in 3 minutes. So thank you very much, our panelists, our rapporteurs, and all participants of our two parallel workshops. Thank you.
We now come to the concluding session of the conference, and the session will be conducted as follows. For the first part of the session, I will give some preliminary conclusions as General Rapporteur for the conference, and then my remarks will be followed by remarks from Ms. Dalila Araújo, who is the Portuguese Deputy Minister of the Interior. And then the closing remarks of the conference will be given by Mr. Osvaldo Castro, the President of the First Committee on Constitutional Affairs, Rights, Freedoms and Guarantees of the Portuguese Parliament. So without further ado, I prefer to stand actually to give these conclusions, so I'll do that. And then I'll pass the floor to my distinguished speakers on my right. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now come to the end of this conference, and I've been tasked as the General Rapporteur, as you know, to provide a number of conclusions based on the discussion during these 2 days. The Council of Europe has brought together a wide range of pertinent stakeholders, including politicians and parliamentarians, government officials from various ministries addressing migration, and international agencies and civil society representatives to discuss this issue of human rights and migration. And I think this space for dialogue has been a laudable achievement in itself. But a loftier challenge was also set for the participants of this conference, namely how best to realise a human rights-based approach to the protection of migrants, refugees and asylum seekers. And speakers in the opening session referred to a human rights-based approach to migration policies and the need to put the individual, migrant, asylum seeker or refugee, at the heart or core of migration policies, whether these are national, European or Council or EU or Council of Europe policies, which are applicable, of course, to the wider Europe. In my preliminary remarks yesterday, I said that the conference presented an opportunity to discuss how to better articulate, formulate, and effectively apply or implement such a human rights-based approach in the specific areas of the thematic workshops, which have addressed interception at sea and related issues, detention of both asylum seekers and migrants, trafficking, exploitation and violence, xenophobia and racism, as well as expulsion and forced returns. And I also said yesterday that this was easier said than done because of a number of tensions pervading the discussion. Firstly, the tension between human rights and state sovereignty. And here, state sovereignty is understood as the sovereign prerogative of the state to manage its borders and determine who may enter its territory, as well as to return and expel those who are deemed not to possess the right to stay. Although, during this discussion, it was also underlined that this tension, unfortunately, is often addressed in favour of state interests, to the extent that disproportionate measures may be introduced, particularly those relating to detention of asylum seekers and migrants, as well as, it was argued, the expulsion of so-called non-national terrorist suspects. Another tension pervading our discussions has been between the principled debate on human rights and migration and the realities and difficulties politicians face in needing to provide responses to public opinion, which is often hostile. And the final tension between the harsh realities of the economic crisis on one hand, which gives rise to tendencies towards closure, protectionism, and restriction on rights, as well as on migration, and the recognized continued need for migration in certain sectors of the economy, as well as the need to ensure that international obligations to protect refugees and the human rights of migrants are upheld. And fulfillment of such obligations cannot be circumscribed in times of crisis, and indeed become even more urgent. Now, as discussed during the conference, there are numerous instruments, tools, and mechanisms in place to clearly articulate and apply a human rights approach to the protection of migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers in national and European policies. And let me just give you a few examples. With regard to legally binding instruments, internationally there are, of course, the core international human rights conventions applicable to all persons regardless of nationality or immigration status. And here, one of them is the Convention on Migrant Workers, the 1990 Convention. It's important because most of the 214 recognized international migrants today are in some way or another connected with the world of work. However, this instrument has only been accepted by a few Council of Europe member states and not a single EU member state. There is also here the international labour law of the ILO, which of course protects all persons in their working environment, including the two specific ILO instruments protecting migrant workers, Conventions 197 and 143, which perhaps we did not discuss in a great detail during the course of this conference. Regionally, at the level of the Council of Europe, we have the European Convention on Human Rights, of course, which has been applied to protect migrants and refugees, although, as we discussed in the first session, the application of this convention to migrants differs. The case law with regard to certain articles is more developed than with respect to others. At the level of the European Union, we've also seen the entry into force of the Lisbon Treaty, which has strengthened the EU's human rights framework, in particular by giving legally binding force to the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, as well as obliging the European Union to accede to the Council of Europe Convention on Human Rights. But I think also it's important not to overlook other pertinent Council of Europe instruments, and here in particular I would note the European Social Charter and the Revised Charter, which has been given an expansive interpretation by the European Social Committee to protect vulnerable groups of irregular migrants, particularly the access of irregular migrant children to healthcare and adequate housing. Now, at both international and regional levels, there are also standards which are not necessarily legally binding, sometimes termed as soft law, such as the documents issued by the Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Migrants, the related procedures of the UN Human Rights Council, the recommendations of the Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly. And some of these have been discussed in detail during the conference. So I've just given an overview of some of the most... There's a network of international and regional instruments which many of us, during the course of this conference, considered adequate in the adoption of a human rights approach to migration. However, a significant challenge remains. How best to apply these tools and standards to the specific situation of migrants? Put another way, there is still much to be done to adequately mainstream human rights into migration policies at both the national and European levels. And I said also in my earlier remarks yesterday that most of the five themes that the participants of this conference were requested to discuss were applicable to the whole migration cycle. So the situation in countries of origin before departure, the journeys asylum seekers and refugees and migrants make, conditions in the country of transit, reception on arrival, stay and residence in the destination country, as well as return to the country of origin, as well as and reintegration there. Now, in order to work, a human rights approach needs to comprehensively apply to the whole migration process. And if the human being is to be placed at the core of migration policies, we should not only be concerned with the policies or legislation concerning his or her treatment on arrival in the destination country, but also those policies that could be put in place, for example, in the country of origin, which, if they were adopted and effectively applied, may well have prevented or, at the very least, mitigated much of the resulting abuse and exploitation. So, what are the elements of a human rights-based approach that have been identified in the five specific areas examined during the course of this conference? Let me just go through them quickly. With regard to interception at sea and other related issues, participants were of the view that the package of instruments appears sufficient, both those which are legally binding, such as international human rights standards, including the important principles of equality and non-discrimination, international maritime conventions, or other standards, such as the UNHCR 10-point plan of action. Nevertheless, like with regard to what I've just said earlier, the challenge remains to apply these norms in a consistent and enlightened way, giving full effect to the protection of the human rights of migrants who find themselves in particularly perilous and vulnerable situations. So this calls for rescuing migrants at sea who find themselves in danger, as well as preferably taking them to a country where there's a viable asylum determination system and adequate human rights protection, rather than to a third country where at worst such protections do not exist, or at best their existence is questionable. Protection of fundamental rights and humanitarian assistance needs to be provided to all categories of migrants in the first instance on arrival, before more concrete steps are taken to identify the persons concerned, with a view to determining whether they have special protection needs. For example, if they are refugees, unaccompanied minors, or victims of trafficking. And in this regard, participants underlined that solidarity among a Council of Europe member states, as well as effective collaboration among regional or international agencies and civil society, is especially important. A human rights-based approach in this area should also secure access to justice for migrants intercepted at sea, including the effective use of complaint mechanisms and access to remedies in the event of violations of their rights. With regard to administrative detention of irregular migrants, this is rightly an important concern. Indeed, it reflects the increasing criminalization of migration and migrants, persons who often have committed no criminal offense, and even if they have committed one, according to the law of the country concerned, they have not been prosecuted for it. Indeed, I think it can strongly be argued that a human rights-based approach cannot condone the imposition of criminal sanctions on migrants for mere irregular entry, and the focus instead should be on bringing traffickers, smugglers, and exploitative employers to justice. A human rights approach in this area should also be premised on a presumption against the detention of asylum seekers and irregular migrants. This means that the detention should only be used as a last resort in accordance with legally permissible detention under Article 5.1F of the European Convention on Human Rights, as well as being applied on a case-by-case basis to prevent unauthorized entry of migrants and with a view to their expulsion. They're essentially the wording of Article 5.1F. This approach also requires serious consideration of alternatives to detention, a number of which are specified in the recent Parliamentary Assembly Resolution 1707-2010, and such alternatives should also respect human rights. If detention is indeed resorted to under these exceptional circumstances, at minimum, the treatment the immigration detainee receives in terms of material conditions and procedural rights should not fall below that of persons detained under the auspices of the criminal justice system. Moreover, children should not be detained in any circumstances, which also logically means that if family members are with them, the best interests of the child will require that in most cases there should not be separation of children from parents or for others exercising care over them. Finally, and this was underlined on a number of occasions, if detention is practiced but the legal conditions for detention no longer exist, in other words, there are no prospects for removal, or the maximum length of time permitting detention has expired, the migrant should be released immediately and provided with documentation and the status, which also gives him or her access to economic, including employment and social rights. In other words, to prevent so-called limbo situations in these circumstances. In the session today on trafficking, exploitation and violence, we consider trafficking and related issues. Trafficking, of course, is a particularly heinous crime resulting in multiple human rights abuses. And given this intersection between criminal law and human rights, in theory, it should perhaps be easier to adopt a human rights-based approach to address trafficking, although this is not always the case. The risk here is that activities may be subsumed in approaches focusing on border and migration controls as well as criminal justice system approaches. While, of course, all of these approaches, including the human rights approach, should complement one another, as manifested in the concept of the four P's, prevention, protection, punishment, and partnerships. And in this regard, the importance of prevention and awareness raising was stressed, and again, I think, reflects that a human rights-based approach needs to be focused on the whole migration cycle, including action in countries of origin. In this session too, it was underlined that the focus on human trafficking should not overshadow other forms of exploitation that migrants suffer in host countries, particularly the exploitation concerned or connected with poor and abusive working conditions experienced by migrants in both irregular and regular situations. Now, while this treatment may well amount to trafficking in some circumstances, it is more often than not a matter of employment standards and their effective implementation, and a purely migration-centered or counter-trafficking approach is insufficient and may even be counterproductive. A human rights-based approach to migration cannot ignore the efforts that need to be undertaken to combat racism, discrimination, and xenophobia. A broad approach to this question is necessary and should include unfair distinctions against migrants on the basis of a number of grounds, including their nationality. And as with the other themes discussed during this conference, there are numerous hard and soft law measures addressing this issue, such as the International Convention Against All Forms of Racial Discrimination, Council of Europe instruments, particularly Protocol No. 12, and the important and innovative work of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. A comprehensive approach or policy to combat discrimination and xenophobia against migrants is also laid out in the Durban Declaration and Programme of Action. Once again, adequate implementation is key, and this needs to be supported by supplementary measures focusing on the training of professionals and specialists, as well as education of all members of the host society, starting with young children. And in addition, intercultural activities. And support of official programs here by and partnerships with civil society actors in this endeavor is crucial. The question of expulsion and forced return probably represents, or best represents, this tension between state sovereignty and human rights in the field of migration. From the perspective of a human rights-based approach, the challenge here is to ensure an appropriate balance or equilibrium is achieved. Human rights-sensitive measures here include full respect for the fundamental principle of non-refoulement, the prohibition on collective expulsion, and in particular here, ensuring that each case is considered on an individual basis, a principle which is also applicable, for example, to the interception of migrants at sea. Priority to voluntary return, and of course the returns directive does give priority to voluntary return, although the question remains whether sufficient time is given for voluntary return under the directive. Human rights monitoring of readmission agreements, as well as other return operations. And I just wanted to note here that in the recent European Commission proposal to extend or to amend the mandate of Frontex, there are interesting provisions there about monitoring return operations from a fundamental rights perspective. It remains to be seen whether the Council will take these suggestions on board. And finally, I would like to add here, and this was raised in the context of expulsion and forced return during the first session, the need for suspensive effect of return decisions and particular care to be taken in the context of the treatment of so-called non-national terrorist suspects, other issues that can feed into a human rights approach in this area. So in conclusion, I just want to highlight a number of cross-cutting themes that may be gleaned from the discussions at this conference. First, the issue of data was raised on a number of occasions, and the difficulty of collecting good statistics, especially when often the subjects of concern are in a regular situation or perhaps an exploitative domestic situations. Good policy making requires data based on sound evidence. And so this remains a major challenge, requiring a consistent approach and further cooperation and coordination among the competent institutions. Secondly, the economic crisis pervaded most of the discussions at the conference. While, as I've noted earlier, the crisis cannot be an excuse for reducing refugee and human rights protection, the risk is that such protections may be reduced indirectly through the withdrawal or withholding of funds for important programs that assist certain categories of migrants, such as withholding support for victims of trafficking, as well as support for equality and anti-discrimination bodies. Third, the idea was expressed at this conference that protection of human rights of migrants is a shared responsibility. Human rights migration policies start in the country of origin. However, partnerships between all the countries involved in the migration process are also necessary. Such partnerships should not only focus on the migration phenomenon itself, but should also address root causes, as was underlined in the session on trafficking, exploitation and violence. Further, while there is certainly a moral obligation on Council of Europe member states to assist each other, and particularly those countries in southern Europe most affected by mixed migratory flows, refugee and human rights protection remains paramount. So in other words, basic human rights obligations are not negotiable. Moreover, the concept of shared responsibility goes beyond mixed flow situations and can also be applied to efforts to educate and raise awareness of host populations about the facts of migration, as well as the need to combat racism and xenophobia against migrants. Raising awareness here also means showing or demonstrating the contributions and dynamism migrants bring to both destination and origin societies, their entrepreneurship, innovation, the richness of diversity, and so on. Yes, the primary responsibility in this regard lies with elected representatives of the state, but other actors such as civil society representatives and international and regional organizations have an important role to play here too. And fourth and finally, a human rights-based approach is not exclusive. And here I'm particularly grateful to Ms. Joy Ngozi-Azolo, the UN Special Rapporteur on Trafficking in Persons, for underlining this point in the workshop on trafficking, exploitation and violence. A human rights approach should be seen as complementary to other approaches, including those concerned with border and migration control and criminal justice. Indeed, an objective of this conference has been to ensure that human rights find their rightful place in the formulation and implementation of migration policies. Otherwise, these policies cannot succeed. And in this respect, I commend the Council of Europe for taking this bold and important initiative. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. These are my conclusions to this conference. I now wish to invite Ms. Dalila Araújo, the Portuguese Deputy Minister of the Interior, to take the floor.
Institucionais, Direitos, Liberdades e Garantias na Assembleia da República. Senhor Presidente da Comissão das Migrações, Refugiados e População da Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa, Senhor Presidente da Assembleia Parlamentar do Comitê Europeu das Migrações do Conselho da Europa, Senhoras e Senhores Deputados, Senhoras e Senhores Convidados. Em nome do Ministério da Administração Interna, gostaria de deixar uma palavra de agradecimento às diversas entidades organizadoras que tornaram possível esta conferência e expressar o meu reconhecimento a todos os intervenientes que, pelo seu saber e pela partilha de experiências, enriqueceram o debate sobre um tema de reconhecida importância e atualidade no mundo em que vivemos. Cabe-me intervir neste painel de encerramento e, mais do que alinhar conclusões que já foram aqui referidas com bastante detalhe e com grande qualidade, eu gostaria, em jeito de balanço, de partilhar convosco algumas reflexões. E começando por uma interrogação. Por que realizamos esta conferência? Qual é a razão? Para relembrar a todos, a comunidade internacional, os governos nacionais, a sociedade civil, que os imigrantes não são cidadãos de segunda classe e que não devem ser privados dos seus direitos quando, por alguma razão, deixam as suas casas, os seus países e procuram um futuro melhor, mais próspero, mais seguro ou mais livre. Como é referido nas linhas gerais de enquadramento desta conferência, nos últimos anos, os movimentos migratórios se tornaram-se mais complexos e com um caráter mais misto. As pessoas viajam juntas, utilizam os mesmos meios de transportes, contratam os serviços dos mesmos traficantes e são expostas aos mesmos riscos e aos mesmos abusos. Vivemos numa sociedade global suportada por comunicações eficazes e acessíveis, com transportes céleres, e projetamos também imagens de sociedades de bem-estar e de progresso e de liberdade com enorme capacidade de atração. E por isso não nos deve surpreender o número crescente de cidadãos migrantes que demandam os vários países da Europa, nem o caráter mutável dos fluxos migratórios alterando os perfis e os destinos. O esforço para gerir estes fluxos de imigrantes que chegam às nossas fronteiras devem assentar em compromissos sérios na partilha de valores comuns, de democracia, de respeito pelo primado da lei e pelos direitos humanos. Como foi relembrado nestes dois dias da conferência, os temas da interseção no mar, a detenção de requerentes de asilo, a imigração ilegal, o tráfico de seres humanos, a exploração e a violência, a xenofobia e o racismo, a expulsão e o retorno forçado, são áreas onde os direitos dos imigrantes nem sempre são plenamente respeitados e, por vezes, são mesmo violados, comprometendo os valores fundamentais em que as nossas sociedades se baseiam. Temos todos presente a preocupante situação de dezenas de milhares de pessoas que chegam de barco às costas do sul da Europa em fluxos migratórios mistos e dos quais, tragicamente, muitas virão aparecer no esforço de alcançar o mundo novo que tanto anseiam. É, antes de mais, uma grave situação humanitária e que levanta pertinentes questões de direito internacional, nomeadamente na aplicação da legislação relativa aos refugiados e, essencialmente, dos direitos humanos. Refletimos também, e já foi aqui bem identificado, sobre as formas de garantir que a detenção de requerentes de asilo e de imigrantes irregulares seja utilizada como o último e não como o primeiro recurso, e sobre a necessidade de ter em consideração alternativas à detenção, garantindo em simultâneo a aplicação pelos Estados dos requisitos para a detenção de requerentes de asilo e de imigrantes irregulares. Relativamente ao tráfico de seres humanos, um dos crimes mais condenáveis associados à imigração legal e que viola os direitos básicos, foi unânime o reconhecimento da necessidade de um combate firme, determinado, sem tréguas a este flagelo dos nossos tempos. As vítimas deste crime, sabemos todos, acabam muitas vezes por ser exploradas economicamente em trabalhos degradantes e, em alguns casos, em autênticos sistemas de clausura, a que nem a consciência dos Estados ou dos cidadãos pode ficar indiferente. Exige-se neste domínio um alerta social permanente, uma ação dos poderes públicos cada vez mais concertada na prevenção e na repressão deste fenómeno. Ao longo destes debates da conferência, ganhou evidência reforçada para todos a consciência de que o combate eficaz aos crimes associados à imigração ilegal que colocam em risco os direitos humanos é também uma das formas mais eficazes de proteger os próprios direitos humanos. Para combater o racismo, a xenofobia, a intolerância, ficou mais uma vez patente que os Estados devem assegurar a existência de uma sociedade plural, no respeito mútuo pelas diferenças, no quadro de uma partilha de valores comum, na qual os imigrantes possam integrar-se como cidadãos de corpo inteiro, assumindo em plenitude os direitos e os deveres da cidadania ativa das sociedades democráticas contemporâneas. Foi dada especial e merecida atenção aos processos de expulsão de imigrantes irregulares e às respectivas implicações em matéria de direitos humanos nas atuais políticas e prática do retorno e admissão, tendo-se realçado e bem a necessidade de garantir sempre a salvaguarda desses direitos e, em especial, no que toca às crianças e, em especial, às crianças não acompanhadas. O trabalho da comunidade internacional é aqui essencial para preservar os direitos dos imigrantes no quadro dos conflitos existentes no mundo. E, neste sentido, as instituições das Nações Unidas sobre Direitos Humanos, como o Alto Comissário para os Direitos Humanos, o Alto Comissário para os Refugiados ou o OIT, são agentes importantes de intervenção para monitorizar os direitos humanos dos imigrantes. No plano europeu, ao nível da Europa que habitamos, realçamos a relevância e a eficácia da atividade do Conselho da Europa e das suas instituições. E não querendo ser exaustiva, eu referi aqui o Comitê Europeu para a Prevenção da Tortura e dos Tratamentos Desumanos ou Degradantes, o Tribunal Europeu dos Direitos do Homem, a ECRI, o Comissário dos Direitos Humanos do Conselho da Europa e a própria Assembleia Parlamentar, de que Vossas Excelências são dignos representantes. É importante que este trabalho seja reforçado de uma forma cada vez mais concertada e que o Conselho da Europa continue a ser um veículo e uma instituição importante de salvaguarda desses direitos. E neste contexto cumpre mencionar as ações do Conselho, que muitas vezes servem de base a outras iniciativas, nomeadamente na defesa dos direitos humanos, no combate ao tráfico de seres humanos, na definição de políticas e de estratégias de combate às redes de imigração ilegal, otimizando os benefícios dos fluxos migratórios, quer para os países de origem, quer para os países de destino. É sem dúvida meritória a forma como o Conselho da Europa supervisiona e assegura a proteção de direitos e liberdades fundamentais, sensibiliza a percepção da opinião pública sobre esta matéria, promove a educação para os direitos humanos, contribui para a formação profissional dos que nela atuam ou identifica as ameaças que surgem e que põem em risco a dignidade humana. Esta capacidade de intervenção do Conselho da Europa muito deve à sua natureza de organismo aglutinador, integrando países de origem, trânsito e destino das migrações, o que lhe permite desenvolver uma estratégia concertada e ter uma visão muito alargada da gestão de fluxos migratórios e reforçar as modalidades de cooperação entre os diversos países. Caros participantes e convidados, termino reforçando uma ideia, não sei se é a principal, mas é uma ideia fundamental e que ressaltou das conclusões que o meu antecessor aqui identificou. É de que só com uma resposta global que junte no mesmo esforço os países de origem, de trânsito e de destino, poderemos fazer face aos desafios crescentes e em constante evolução que se colocam aos fluxos migratórios na aldeia global que é a nossa e no espaço de liberdade, segurança e justiça da União Europeia. É na persecução destes objetivos que o Governo que o nosso governo desenvolve as políticas para as migrações no respeito pelos direitos humanos, na aceitação da diversidade e na abertura à diferença e no combate à criminalidade associada à imigração ilegal. Muito obrigada a todos pelo vosso contributo e um bom regresso aos vossos países e continuem na luta deste desígnio que é um desígnio do século XXI. Obrigada a todos.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister Arusha, for those remarks. And now, for the closing remarks, I'd like to invite Mr. Osvaldo Castro, President of the First Committee on Constitutional Affairs, Rights, Freedoms and Guarantees of the Portuguese Parliament.
I know that this Senate room, it's very pretty, but it's also very odd. We are working for transform it. Sr. Assessor da Comissão Interna, Sr. Relator-Geral Richard Solivinski, Srs. E Srs. Deputados da Assembleia da República e da Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa, Srs. E Srs. Presidentes da Organização das Nações Unidas, Sr. Diretor-Geral do SEF e demais entidades oficiais, ilustres convidados, Sras. E Srs. É uma honra produzir a intervenção de encerramento desta conferência, subordinada a um tema que se encontra no núcleo mais essencial dos direitos fundamentais do ser humano. E por isso também um motivo de orgulho ver a Assembleia da República e a Comissão de Assuntos Constitucionais, Direitos, Liberdades e Garantias, a que tenho a honra de presidir, associar-se à organização deste evento ao Governo Português, através do Ministério da Missão Interna e do Serviço de Estrangeiros e Fronteiras, ao Conselho da Europa e à sua Assembleia Parlamentar e à Organização das Nações Unidas, através do Gabinete do Alto Comissário para os Refugiados, Engenheiro António Guterres, verdadeiro ombudsman, provedor de tantas e tantas pessoas que vivem num mundo sem governo, sem proteção, sem representantes e, por vezes, sem defesa. Na verdade, os migrantes em geral e os refugiados e requerentes de asilo, em particular, são ou devem ser os primeiros e principais destinatários da Declaração Universal dos Direitos do Homem em toda a sua amplitude. Estas pessoas forçadas a mudar, levadas a fugir, obrigadas a procurar a sobrevivência longe de casa e de tudo quanto lhes é familiar, perdem imediatamente a qualidade de cidadãos e o que essa característica acarreta por definição. De facto, sempre houve quem se visse forçado a partir em busca de melhores condições de vida. No atual mundo globalizado e imediato de hoje, no mundo em crise, o fenómeno assume proporções verdadeiramente massificadas e preocupantes. Sabemos que, unidos, contados em conjunto, todos os migrantes do mundo criariam a quinta maior nação, um Estado com 244 milhões de habitantes, que só em 2008 criaram, através do seu trabalho, 444 mil milhões de dólares. Um país com cidadãos iguais aos outros, mas, infelizmente, um pouco menos iguais. 244 milhões de seres humanos, cidadãos sem Estado, muitas vezes por serem oriundos de Estados falhados, 244 milhões de histórias de vida, de valores e de oportunidades que, unidos e aproveitados, podem contribuir para fazer um mundo melhor. Mas para que tal seja possível, precisamos de boas soluções. E foi disso mesmo. E por isso vos saúdo a todos os que aqui estão presentes
e especialmente àqueles que mais se empenharam na organização, sem falar na Assembleia, no Governo, ao CEF, à Delegação do Conselho da Europa, enfim, às organizações das Nações Unidas que se empenharam, de facto, nesta organização. Por isso, se falou aqui da qualidade das respostas governamentais aos movimentos migratórios, aceitando o difícil equilíbrio que cada Estado tem de garantir entre o acolhimento e a defesa dos cidadãos, das cada vez mais prementes questões relacionadas com migrações marítimas, tantas vezes um fim inglório de uma vida desesperada, e da sempre delicada problemática da detenção, que aqui já foi abordada, aliás, e que vocês abordaram de uma forma que me parece extremamente bem cuidada. E que não é, dizia a detenção, não é, nem pode ser um fim em si próprio. Se recordarmos que na União Europeia foram detidos em 2008 cerca de 609 mil nacionais de países terceiros em situação irregular, percebemos que a forma como enfrentarmos o problema condiciona o sucesso da sua resolução. Mas falou-se também das faces mais macabras do nosso mundo, o tráfico, a exploração e a violência, em que redes grupos enleiam os mais fracos e desprotegidos seres humanos com o único fito do lucro e dos proventos monetários. Um submundo que não podemos deixar de combater, com maior energia, firmeza e convicção, com os mais eficazes meios, até o dia em que ele não seja mais do que uma memória triste de um tempo pior. Não esquecer da intolerância, o racismo, a xenofobia, o preconceito contra a diferença com que, infelizmente, somos diariamente confrontados e que só mudanças profundas de atitude e de mentalidade conseguirão erradicar. Abordou-se a pena de expulsão figura jurídica pré-constitucional consagrada entre nós, em Portugal, no artigo 33º da nossa Constituição da República, marca de forma claríssima a diferença entre cidadãos e não cidadãos, tendo os primeiros o direito à não expulsão, mas não tendo os segundos o direito à imigração. Aos princípios constitucionais têm sido, aliás, dada a sequência legislativa assinalável de que é exemplo mais recente a Lei do Asilo, a 27 de 2008, debatida e aprovada nesta Assembleia da República, nesta Comissão de Assuntos Constitucionais, Direitos, Liberdades e Garantias, por proposta do anterior Governo, e aprovada sem qualquer voto contra. Transpondo para o ordenamento nacional diretivas comunitárias, esta lei é peça fundamental na consolidação de um espaço europeu de direitos humanos, um espaço único de liberdade, segurança e justiça que prossegue a tradição humanitária do nosso continente. É nessa tradição que se insere o Gabinete Europeu do Asilo, que estará em funcionamento ainda este ano, e a segunda fase, a construção do Sistema Europeu Comum de Asilo, essencial para que possamos ser um verdadeiro exemplo em matéria de integração e de construção de uma sociedade mais plural, mais rica e mais capaz de enfrentar todos os desafios. Desafios que o Estado português tem vindo a ganhar na luta contra a intolerância, que foi padrão em parte significativa do século passado em Portugal. Só explica que um recente estudo levado a cabo, o Índice de Políticas de Integração de Migrantes, ou IPEX, que visa medir as políticas de integração de migrantes levado a cabo em 28 países, 25 Estados-membros da União Europeia e 3 países não pertencentes à União, e as opiniões dos seus cidadãos, relativamente aos imigrantes, colocam Portugal em segundo lugar numa lista encabeçada pela Suécia. E que depois deste estudo, as Nações Unidas, avaliando o grau de desenvolvimento humano, tenham afirmado que Portugal é o país com a melhor classificação na atribuição de direitos e serviços aos estrangeiros residentes. É um conjunto de grandes passos em frente. Mas não creio, e tenho a certeza que o Governo também não pensa assim, que já tenhamos feito tudo. Que temos ainda muito e muito para fazer. Estas são boas notícias, sob todos os prismas. Mas ainda o são mais considerarmos que o nosso país mudou muito no que aos fluxos migratórios respeita. Se é verdade que os portugueses têm no seu ADN muito sangue de imigrante, fruto de 5 séculos e gerações que partiram para novas vidas, não é menos certo afirmar que também somos hoje um país de acolhimento. Destino de tantos e de tantas
que como nós fizemos outros tempos em África, na América, na Ásia e, claro, na Europa, procuram agora em Portugal o mundo melhor com que sonharam e que têm direito a alcançar. Senhor Relator-Geral, Senhora Secretária de Estado, ilustres convidados, senhores e senhores, numa época em que todos vivemos justificadamente preocupados com o contexto económico e financeiro do mundo, é mais importante do que nunca centrarmos as nossas atenções na condição humana, na proteção da sua existência, não só porque ela é pressuposto dos indicadores económicos, mas sobretudo porque é por estes cada vez mais condicionado. O primeiro relatório anual sobre a imigração e o asilo, relativo a 2009, da Comissão ao Parlamento Europeu e ao Conselho, constata o que todos sabemos, que os migrantes são um dos grupos populacionais mais atingidos pela crise. Mas diz também que a imigração proveniente de países terceiros contribuiu para o crescimento de muitos Estados-membros. E não tenhamos dúvidas, Portugal é um dos casos. Para o crescimento e para o aumento da natalidade, por exemplo. Como sabemos, só em conjunto poderemos sair da crise em que caímos. Só aproveitando o contributo de todos poderemos ultrapassar os obstáculos que ainda temos pela frente. Só sendo solidários poderemos viver numa sociedade justa e humana, sem guetos, sem campos ou centros de detenção, numa sociedade plural. É, portanto, nosso dever, como representantes dos cidadãos, assumirmos a representação e defesa dos meus cidadãos, criando condições para que todos os seres humanos sejam tratados com a dignidade e o respeito que lhes devem ser inerentes. Continuando a lutar pela sua liberdade, defendendo uma verdadeira igualdade, e dando substância à fraternidade, valores há tanto proclamados e ainda tão atuais. É por isso minha convicção que devemos dar verdadeira atenção à dimensão da integração das comunidades migrantes, não esquecendo nunca a clareza das regras de admissão, aperfeiçoando umas e outras. Foi nesse esforço que se inseriu a conferência que agora encerra. Uma vez mais sublinho, queria saudar, porque esta conferência trouxe-nos inúmeros ensinamentos. E estou certo que foi um importante passo para o muito que a partir de hoje se continuará a fazer em prol de um mundo em que não haja cidadãos e não cidadãos. Cidadãos de primeira ou cidadãos de segunda, mas em que todos sejamos cidadãos do mundo. Sim, agora que o Tratado de Lisboa tornou vinculativa a Carta dos Direitos Fundamentais da União Europeia, nós devemos trabalhar para que todos sejam cidadãos do mundo. Muito obrigado a todos pela vossa atenção. Boa viagem para todos vocês.
Thank you very much, Mr. Castro, for those remarks. I just want to say a few final words. I committed a little indiscretion in my final remarks because I commended the Council of Europe, and of course I should have also referred to the Council of Europe's partners, so I would like to do that now by thanking the Portuguese Parliament, the Ministry of the Interior, as well as the various constituent elements of the Council of Europe, the Subcommittee on Migration of the Parliamentary Assembly, the Committee, European Committee on Migration, CDMG, as well as, of course, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, who have been involved in the organisation of this conference. Finally, I would also like to thank all those support staff that we have dealt with on one occasion or another, but have perhaps been a bit less visible. This conference would, of course, not be possible without your hard work and commitment. And also to our translators. I'm looking up there, I'm seeing these small booths, and I'm wondering, well, if it's hot here, it must be pretty hot up there. So thank you very much for bearing with us. And finally, to all of you as participants, for staying to the very end. Despite the difficult conditions, I think that reflects very much your commitment to moving forward with a human rights-based approach to migration. Thank you all.